This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
My next guest has sold 12 million albums and been inducted into the ARIA Hall of Fame twice. He's knocked J.K. Rowling off the BookScan number one bestseller spot in Australia and has had more Australian number one albums than the Beatles. His new live show is called Working Class Boy, an evening of songs and stories. Jimmy Barnes, such a pleasure to be speaking with you. Hi.
Thank you, Trina. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. Congratulations on the book. What a massive success that's been. I mean, number one adult title in 2016.
They've loved it. It's gone very well.
Not many people who can say they knocked J.K. Rowling off the number one spot, hey?
Yeah, you know, I think she's done all right for herself anyway. I don't think she's that concerned. But it was a really nice thing. The book's been really well received. I think it's had a good effect on a lot of people and started a lot of conversations, which is really good.
It nearly didn't get written. I understand your first few attempts were thwarted.
Well, yeah, thwarted by myself. The thing was, I had a couple of attempts at writing it. I started in the 90s and really, I wasn't really sure what I was writing about, you know, because at that point I was sort of, you know, I didn't really want to look back at my past, you know. Mm. There's a lot of things from my childhood that I just sort of blocked out. As a kid, it was dangerous and you know, I was unhappy, obviously, so I didn't want to go back there. The book, they say it's a diary, it's a memoir of running away, because I ran away from my past all the time. I ran away from my childhood, ran away from the shame of poverty and the fear of domestic violence. Mm. So I tried not to look back at it. So when I started writing in the 90s, I didn't really get that much done. And I started again in around 2000. And at that time, I was drinking too much. The effects of this childhood was nearly killing me.
So what enabled you to sort of turn around and face it head on?
I just think it was the right time to do it. I don't know. I sat down a couple of years ago. I'm obviously in a lot better state than I have been for a long, long time. I'm healthier and more focused. And, I'm not trying to drink myself to death. And I just think it was the right time. And I sat, you know, somebody suggested I write it, and I thought about it, and you know, this stuff all just, once I thought about it then with a clear head, all this stuff from my childhood just came flooding back to me, and it just poured out of me, and I sat down to write it, you know, thinking, even if I just write this for myself, when I finished writing the book, I sat there and I thought, you know what, I could delete this, you know, tear it up, throw it away, it's done its job already, I've let it out, because I've dealt with it myself. The reason why I put it that was because I realized halfway through writing it that there's a lot of people living with the same stuff that I was running away from that are living with it now. A lot of people have been through the same stuff and aren't coping with it.
Take us back to, you know, Adelaide, the northern suburbs of Adelaide in the 1960s. What was your life like then?
You know what, I used to think it was just normal because, you know, it seemed like a lot of the families that we knew, we grew up in a sort of tight-knit, sort of particularly Scottish, you know, community. All immigrants. Elizabeth in South Australia was a place that was built really around the Holden's factory. And it was, it was a really flat, desolate, horrible piece of land with, hardly any rain. The trees didn't grow well, and they decided they'd bring all the immigrants and stick them there so they could have someone to work at Holden's, basically. Mm. So we came there. We arrived in 1961. And the only people we knew really were Scots and Brits, you know. So it was a very tight-knit community, and most of the people came from working class, you know, northern Britain, and had the same problems as we had. There was a lot of alcoholism, a lot of violence, a lot of abuse. It was just, as a child living there, that was just one of those things where most nights you went to sleep, you know, to the sound of something getting smashed and people yelling and screaming and, you know, and it was a scary place to live.
And how did that childhood shape the rest of your life?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things that go on. You know, we didn't have anything. We'd get clothes from the Salvation Army. We were hungry. You know, my dad would drink all the money, and we wouldn't have any money to eat or do anything. So basically, my parents were preoccupied with their lives. They didn't notice us. They were too busy. My mum trying to survive. And my dad just, you know, drinking. And the violence was sort of full on. And so, you know, as a child coming through that, you tend to try and make people notice you. And so I sort of was a bit of an achiever. I sort of was, I'd be top of my class. I'd be the captain of the football team. You know, I was, you know, I was ducks of the school when the first few years of high school. Making people like me. I joined a band, and you know, and what do you do in a rock and roll band? You stand at the front of a crowd and go, "Look at me, look at me." And so I spent most of my life trying to make people like me, because to make me feel safe. I thought, you know, if people like me, then I'm worth something, and yeah. That's been really what's driven me for 55 years.
Is that what music gave you, Jimmy? Did it give you that sense of approval and of being worthwhile and people noticing you?
Yeah, it did. It did. But it was a funny thing. It also, you know, without even knowing about, you know, or trying not to ever look back on this life, it gave me an outlet. So every night I'd get on stage, and I'd be able to let out the anger. I'd be able to let out the fear. I'd be able to let out the lack of hope. I'd be able to, you know, let out the love. You know, the stuff that I hadn't been able to do in my own life, I was allowed to let these emotions run free on stage. And in fact, you know, the more I did, the more people liked it.
Yeah. I mean, now you're actually literally letting out those stories on stage and telling those stories. Does that take a lot out of you to get up and do that night after night?
It's very tiring. I mean, it's a long show anyway, but it's emotionally tiring, which is much different to doing like a hard rock and roll show. It's a different sort of time. Some nights I get up there and I think, oh, I'm breezing through this, you know, because I can do it with some sort of, I can stand back a little bit from it now that I've written it, and particularly since I've done a few shows and I can sort of be a bit more objective and look at it. But there'll be points in every show where suddenly something new will occur to me, or I'll be talking about a situation and I can see someone's face in the audience and I know they've been through the same. And I'll be talking or singing and I'll notice a new, you know, expression on one of my children's faces, and suddenly it just all becomes very difficult to do. So it's, you know, there's points in every show where I, you know, and different points there every night where it gets really hard. But it's emotionally draining. But it's also, you know, quite rewarding. You come off and you feel like, you know, you've communicated with people. You've reached people.
Yeah. It's quite amazing that you're sharing this experience. I know you have Mahalia and Jackie on stage with you. Has that been a special thing to do this together?
Well, you know, it's really incredible. I mean, I don't think I could have done it without them. It's musically, the way this thing works, it's so intimate. You know, we've got an upright bass and a guitar, which is my son-in-law, Ben Rogers. Mahalia singing, and Jackie, my son, sits and plays drums and piano, sometimes at the same time, while singing.
Yeah.
And so it's really tight and it's really intimate. And as opposed to where, you know, most of the shows I've done in my life where we sort of reach out and jump in people's faces, this show sits back and draws people in. And that really takes it to, you know, makes people very emotional. It's doing these songs with my children. I think part of the healing has been the healing. My children have seen the effects that this my childhood had on me. They've seen it nearly kill me over the years. They've seen me drink myself to death. They've worried about me. And to see me getting it out of, you know, my system on stage, you know, I think is enlightening to them. I think it answers a lot of the questions that they have about me and about the effects that it's had on them. And also, I think it's a bit joyous because we get to see that I'm letting it go.
It's just amazing in a way, and precious, that you've been able to do this in your lifetime, because so often people can't face up to these things and it's left to the next generation to then do that. But you said that, you know, your story has really resonated with people. Why do you think that this story has resonated so strongly with Australians?
There's a lot of immigrants here, a lot of people with similar stories. Doesn't matter whether it's Italians, Greeks, Vietnamese or whatever, they drag themselves across from their home to start a new home, hoping for something better. And we're all here. So we share a common sort of background, a lot of us. Mm. But there's a lot of us, you know, even, you know, third, fourth generation Australians who are living or have lived in poverty, who have lived in or are living with domestic violence. Domestic violence, everybody knows how big a problem it is in this country. And, you know, we can talk around it and try to sort of understand it and talk about it. But, you know, really when it comes down to it, it's, you know, men are the perpetrators of this. You know, women are the victims and men are the perpetrators. And a lot of it's got to do with, you know, you can feel the growing tide that's changing as far as women's rights. And I think in a lot of men, they get scared of it.
There's something
that's really a big movement that's happened. And unfortunately, you know, I think even like you look at Rosie Batty, her story, the more she spoke about it, seemed the more domestic violence went up, the incidents went up. And one study I heard said that because men are fearing they're being cornered and they're getting more afraid and striking out. This is a big, big problem in this country, and it's a problem we all share. If you're a victim of this, you know, you have to talk about it. We have to get it, you know, get it out in the open. If you're a child that's been subjected to this, you have to get help. You have to talk to the therapist. If you're a perpetrator of this, you know, nobody's proud of being like that. Nobody's happy about it. You know, and that shame causes them pain. They've got to get help too. It's just a huge problem.
Yeah, I know you're drawing attention to the Luke Batty Foundation on this tour as well, and that you're very passionate about that. What did you learn about yourself from, you know, writing the book, reflecting on all this and telling these stories?
You know what? I learned that your life changes. You know, it's not written down in stone. Nothing is set in stone. You know, you don't have to live in the situation you're in. You can change it. You can leave it behind. You can deal with it. You know, I think I find that people, and you know, myself, you know, are much more resilient than I ever imagined. Mm. You know, one of the reasons I've managed to stick around to write this down, you say people don't normally get a chance to do it, is because I'm tough, and people are tougher than you think. Yeah. You know, and that brings me back to that domestic violence thing too. You look at Rosie Batty, how the hell did she live through that? And not only live through it, but go on to become a spokesperson and you know, and helping people get through this. People are tougher than you thought, and that's what I found out about myself.
Okay. And now, is there a song that I could play that best sums up this journey that you've been on?
Without giving the show away, one of the songs we do at the end of the show is a song that I've sang every night for years, and it makes me, you know, it gives me knots in my stomach every time I sing it or hear it. But it's a song that means a lot to me, and that's Flame Trees.
Okay. Well, let's hear that one out. We've been speaking with Aussie rock legend Jimmy Barnes. His Working Class Boy and Evenings of Songs and Stories is coming up at the Enmore Theatre on Saturday, March 25th. Thank you so much.
And listen, you know what? Could I tell you too, but this Enmore is nearly gone for people who want to come. We've decided we're going to put on an extra show. We're going to do a show at the State Theatre on the 12th of April, just as the final show of the tour. Because, you know, this you know, due to demand, and we want everybody to get out and come and see this show. The State Theatre is going to be the last show we do on the tour, and it should be very, very special.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for letting us know about that.
No worries. Thanks, Katrina. Very nice to talk to you.
Very nice to talk to you.